Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth, straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden, and I'm working
at... An Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents, for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Well, hello, everybody. Just me today. Just Chuck. We don't have Julie today. But we've got a great show. And we're going to make an announcement after our first guest that will just blow your mind. An incredible court victory by Republicans in Colorado that was almost unexpected, but it's really going to should change a lot of things. But first, we've got Roy Johnson. We've had him on before, a wonderful author. He was very much from a scientific background and worked in with agribusiness and Cargill and everything else. But he's a full-blown author, and his latest book is called The American Phoenix, The Rise of Donald Trump. And it's great to have him on, Roy.
Good to be here, Chuck. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Now, you've moved down to Colorado Springs, a slightly more friendly territory for yourself.
Yep.
You're enjoying it down there?
Loving it. Not as much Trump derangement syndrome down here.
Yeah, well, I've got plenty in Denver. Well, tell us about your great new book and why you decided to write it and all those things.
Yeah, well, last Christmas of 2004, after Trump won, I knew that we had just witnessed a miracle in November of that year. Because if you remember my last book, We All Fall Down, The Dissolution of America, I ended very pessimistically because I didn't think at that point we would ever see another conservative Republican president again.
Right.
Because I lost complete confidence in our election process.
Sure.
But lo and behold, Trump won. And here we are. And so I thought, with Trump winning, okay, let's start the year off with a miracle. And I thought, this probably means 2025 and 2026 are going to be two of the most important years in the history of the country. And so the book is about that first year.
Okay.
The way I approach these histories is writing history as it happens. Most histories, as you know, are written in retrospect, years in retrospect oftentimes. And can often be clouded by the distance between the time the person is writing and when the events happened.
Right.
So these books are written as it happened with the commentary, referencing commentary that was accompanying those events. And then the other thing that I provide, that I try to provide at least for the reader, is the historical, long-term historical perspective on the key issues. So, for example, I think the most important challenge that we face that has been gifted us by the Democratic Party was open borders and illegal immigration. By my estimates, using hard data, we have anywhere from 25 to 32 million illegal aliens in this country today. Millions of them have Social Security numbers, and a lot of them vote. And that's the threat, because they're going to vote to that entity or that party that they think is in their best interest. And that's why I put that as the number one issue. So a lot of people, they are aware of that as an issue, but very few people can explain how we got here to be at this point where it's such a problem. So I take the time in just the real-time history to go back and just provide people the long-term perspective, how we got here to this situation where we've got anywhere from 25 to 32 million illegal aliens in the country. And I do that on every key issue.
Well, let's kind of stay on the immigration, because as you said, that's really the key.
Yeah.
One. How did we get here?
Oh, man, it starts way back. We lingered. Well, if you go back to actually the days when you and I were kids, back in the 50s, after World War II, agriculture and some construction business in the United States needed workers. We had a lot of guys who had returned from the military, but not enough to supply, especially to supply that low-end farm labor. And so they started what they called the Bracero program. I don't know if you remember that, but I grew up in South Texas, and the Bracero program ended in 1962. So it went all the way through Truman and Eisenhower into the beginning of Kennedy's presidency. And it provided that entry level. And what they would do is they'd bring them across, let them work for a season. The farmers would give them a encampment area or some kind of housing. And then they'd take them back in trucks when the season, when the harvest was over. That was the Bracero program. But a lot of these people over time stayed, right?
Yeah.
And then you fast forward through and you have people crossing illegally, you know, what we today call gotaways. They're not going through, they're not crossing a bridge. They're swimming a river or walking across the Arizona border or California border and essentially sneaking in and disappearing into a Latino community somewhere.
Right.
And that's how it started. Then
we'll talk about Eisenhower. Eisenhower did a massive deportation program back in the 1950s, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. But they had in the very early going, but the lobby from the farm industry and construction convinced him that the Bracero program was a way to meet that labor need, but yet at the same time, you know, not sort of what today I would say is compromised our sovereignty in a way, with 10% of the population or more being illegal. And if they're all totally aligned with one party, then that pretty much, when you've got a 50-50 election every year, that's enough. I mean, just in the 2020 election alone, if you go back and look at IRS data, there was a report back in 2014, IRS data, estimating then that there were 19 million. And those are the ones who had filled out the census.
Wow.
When we did the census, they identified themselves as being here, but not as citizens. So that was in 2014. So we know we're upwards pushing 30 million today, because we just with immigration and border control data, you can just go online, look it up today. And during Biden's 4 years, we had 11.8 million that identified themselves as wanting amnesty. And so they were allowed to come in, you know, with, you know, promise to return for their court appearance. Then the estimate on top of that is at least 1.2 million gotaways. So there's 13 million that came in just during Biden's 4 years.
Right.
That's the population of New York and Los Angeles in 4 years. So it's just inundated. Every system, education system, healthcare.
Yeah. How does Trump done with regards to that? I mean, he's obviously done
well
on the border. It's unclear how good he's done on the deportation end.
Deportation is the challenge. I mean, the border is completely controlled. And here's another irony. If you remember, even the minority Senate under what's his name? McConnell, Mitch McConnell, under Mitch McConnell, wanted to do a deal with Schumer, a border bill.
Yeah.
That would allow minimums. It was a lot of smoke and mirrors. Thank goodness that didn't happen. But they said it was the only way.
Yes, yes.
Then Trump gets in, and within 6 months, there essentially is no almost immeasurable border illegal border crossings.
Right.
He's got the Remain in Mexico policy. People who want to apply for amnesty, they have to stay in Mexico and wait for their hearing.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So he's done a magnificent job. Deportation, bigger challenge, but we know a part of the reason there is this resistance against ICE.
Well, how many were deported last year of the or
well, you know, I don't really know what the real number is. It's hard to get a real number. The administration claims there were 2.5 to 3 million, and at least half of those they say self-deported.
Right.
You know, they came up with a real. The Biden administration implemented this thing called the CBP1 app, so illegals could go on, get that, download it onto a phone given to them by the United Nations, and, you know, book a ticket to the United States, essentially. They could get debit cards, all kinds of stuff. Well, the Trump Homeland Security, under Kristi Noem at the time, just reverse engineered that thing so that now the illegals could go in and say, hey, I'm here, you know, I want to go back. And by doing that, by self-deporting, they now have the right to come back in legally at a future point in time. And so that's accounted for probably half of the deportations,
well, so
according to the administration.
You think he's done a good job on the deportations? Or, I mean, it's, a lot of them criticize that there's really not very many people deported, per se. And obviously, he seems to have lost the PR battle, certainly up in Minnesota.
It's an enormous, enormous task. In the book, I tried to analyze. In fact, the Democratic committee—I forget which committee it was—in the House estimated before they turned over control to the Trump administration that the cost of deportation. And I didn't go back and see how they calculated it, but they said it would be $83 billion. Okay.
Right.
That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money. But if we have, let's say we have 25 million illegals here. And if it's the Foundation for Immigration has estimated that the cost of illegal aliens, this is net any income tax they might pay or employment tax, the net cost to the American citizen is $8,000 per illegal. So that puts the total cost every year over $200 billion just to support the illegal population. So if we spend, let's say, $100 billion deporting them, we're making money already. Right. And once they're deported, that $200 billion expense every year goes away. So it's worth it.
Well, Trump brought before the Supreme Court today the birthright citizenship.
Yeah.
Question, and I couldn't exactly, you know, you can't really rely on CNN or some of the other ones on how the oral arguments went. It certainly seemed that Roberts will vote against Trump.
I know.
Amy Coney Barrett, and I guess it's Gorsuch, may also, which would give them you know, the majority they need. But who knows? Do you have any prediction on that in that case?
My analysis is like yours, unfortunately. And one of the things I do write about this Roberts Supreme Court in the book, and the disappointment, at least for me, in the picks that President Trump actually made himself. he relied on, his advisors at Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, Coney, were going to be good, solid conservatives. Hasn't turned out that way. And Coney is the most consistent. She's almost with Roberts every time. So I'll be surprised if so we have the 14th Amendment. That's where this quote birthright citizenship idea comes from. So the Supreme Court has got to come down with a ruling, or, and I think what it will be is some kind of clarification as to how they, what they interpret the 14th Amendment really means, because there's, as you know, the debate on both sides, it was really written for right after slavery to accommodate those who had been brought in against their will to be slaves. And so they were not under the jurisdiction, but people who fly in to have a baby in the United States so that they can then, that baby eventually can claim U.S. citizenship. And then you have chain migration, bring all the relatives with them down the road. To me, that is the most absurd interpretation that we could, you could ever imagine, which is what, of course, the way the Democrats look at it. But my fear is that Roberts, I think, almost certainly will look at it that way. The wild cards are Coney and Kavanaugh and Gorsuch.
Well, what are the other topics that you covered in the book?
Well, the interesting thing about the book is, again, it's a history written as it's happened. So I deal with these events as they're coming up in the news cycle, or as the president brings them up and points the spotlight on them. So the immigration problem is the first big one. I deal with that first. Of course, then the economy is the next big one. We had to get the one big, beautiful bill across the finish line. As we started out during last year, I was not optimistic that we could have that happen. We only had a 5-seat majority in the House, a 3-seat majority in the Senate. The Senate, of course, being the more difficult challenge, because we know that at least three of these people, four, I could say four, are about as rhino as you can get. Very undependable. But they managed to do it, which to me, if nothing else happens during Trump's term, he stopped illegal immigration. Now, whether we can deport these people or not, I think ultimately we will be able to, because all of these temporary restraining orders and injunctions are falling away. It's very painful to wait for them to fall away or get overruled finally. But almost without exception, they're being overruled eventually. And I think the deportations will happen. It's just going to take longer than we, than those of us on the conservative side would like.
The immigration, economy, what's next?
The economy. Then after that, we've got just the attack on traditional American values that has been perpetrated on the American public, especially during the Biden years, beginning way back, though, in the Obama years, of course. This thing called DEI was so acted almost like a cancer and guaranteed mediocrity in our workforce, mediocrity in our education, mediocrity in our healthcare system. Mediocrity. I mean, look at the example of air traffic controllers, for example. Back in the Obama administration, he started DEI with the air traffic controllers. We had 1,000 people who had gone through the training who were exemplary, but yet they didn't have the right skin color, and they were passed over. And so we had this terrible collision with the with the military helicopter and the commercial flight at Reagan National back in early 2025. And you got to go back. They were shorthanded in the control tower.
Yeah.
That was a part of that problem. Now, the inexperience of the helicopter driver was the other one,
right.
Helicopter pilot. But she was, well, anyway, I don't want to go there. But DEI was still is, but terribly corrosive and counterproductive issue that was leading to just mediocrity around in our business community and everywhere else. So you talk about the other thing is law and order. We've got with the importation of millions and millions of illegal aliens, along with them, we brought in 650,000 known criminals,
right.
13,000 of which were murderers, convicted murderers. We allowed to come in 60,000 of which were Chinese males of military age who came through Panama. 39 of which were known on the terrorist watch list. It's mind blowing what the Biden administration allowed to happen. So law and order began to erode. We have the Soros elected district attorneys in many big cities that began to say, remember, they raised the limits of misdemeanor theft is. It had to go up to $1,000 before the DA would even prosecute them. And a lot of those laws have now been repealed. But we had the defund the police movements. Now we've got defund ICE movements. You just think back to the 2020 election year, the year of George Floyd. That year we had over 400 riots across the country, cost several people their lives, billions of dollars. And now in the first year of, right now we have the No Kings movement.
Yeah.
And it's the same people, Antifa, Black Lives Matter, funded by, you know, Roy Singman out of China, George Soros, Reid Hoffman, the guy who owns LinkedIn. These left-wing billionaires are funding anarchy in the country. So law and order has been a huge issue, still is a huge issue. It's a tough one.
Let me ask you this. You said, you know, you're writing it as it's happening. So,
yeah.
For example, on the Big Beautiful Bill, you know, your view is that it's unlikely to pass. And so I assume that's kind of reflected in some of the pages. And then, you know, you get toward the end and go, yay, we passed. So how does that work where you change your mind considerably from beginning to end?
Absolutely. That happens throughout the book.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of a glass half full kind of guy. So I tend to be pessimistic about things. I mean, I'm not a Republican. I'm an independent because back when John Boehner was Speaker of the House, I got so fed up with the Republican whining and accomplishing nothing.
Right.
When George Bush was president, here's an interesting factoid. If you look back, starting in, let's say, with Truman in 1947, begin in 47. So during those several decades, Dwight Eisenhower was a Republican president. He had the majorities in the House and the Senate for 2 years.
Yeah.
Only 2 years, one Congress. Then you fast forward all the way. Reagan never had it.
No.
You go all the way to George Bush.
Yeah.
And that's when I got frustrated with the Republicans because they had the presidency and they had the Congress for 6 years and accomplished they passed a tax reduction bill. That's about all they did. And George Bush, I hate to say it, his housing and urban development was a big cause of of the economic crash in 2007 and 8.
Absolutely. That is,
yeah.
It is so many.
That was under George Bush.
Right.
A lot of the immigration, illegal immigration, ramped up under George Bush. I hate to say it. Republican president, I voted for him. Now, we did have Iraq. Okay, I don't think anybody today would say Iraq was a good idea.
No,
at the time,
not,
though.
Not so much. Not so much.
Yeah. So then after George Bush, you don't have a Republican president with majorities again until Trump's first term, his first 2 years, and now.
Right.
And that's why one of the quotes that I make in the book is from Patton, George Patton. And he said, a plan executed today with aggressively is a lot better than a plan executed next week weekly or something like that. And so if you look at what Trump is doing today, people are, their heads are, have been spinning ever since he took office. And he is following Patton's advice because he knows he has 2 years with a majority in both houses.
That's going to run out in 6 months.
There's a good chance it will run out.
All right. Any other big topics on the list, on the book?
Well, let's see here. The economy, we talked about that. Oh, here's something about the economy. Two things are so important about the Big Beautiful Bill. If you go back to 2019, the annual federal budget was $4.4 billion in round numbers. That was 2019. Then we had COVID, right? Yeah. Rolling into the end of 19, into 2020. Or no, the end of 2020. Yeah, that was right. And so we go through the election year, and it was COVID, the draconian measures from COVID, where we abandoned legislated election laws in a lot of states. We allowed mass mail-in ballots. We didn't verify signatures. We had voting machines that are insecure everywhere, and a lot of people went to bed on election night there in November 2020, thinking Trump was going to win, and they woke up and he was behind.
I was
so, so if we had not had COVID, that wouldn't have happened. But anyway, the budget was $4.4 billion. In 2024, it was $6.4 billion. So COVID didn't last that long, but the spending did.
Your book is sort of, just like Truman Capote kind of wrote, his In Cold Blood, which was kind of reality one that kind of broke the kind of the mold. You're doing that yourself. I mean, most histories are written from afar a little bit, and that, deemed to have give you perspective and everything else. But there's something really exciting in what you're doing, in which you're describing history day by as it's happening. So it's an extraordinary kind of exciting way of.
And you can see my emotions, just as you mentioned a little while ago, as I'm writing and as things are happening. You see my pessimism, then you'll see my euphoria. I mean, even within one chapter, there's a subtitle that says, let there be optimism.
All right.
And 2 pages later, it said, let there be negativism.
Well, Roy, it's great having you on, and the book sounds fantastic.
There it is.
Oh, there it is. There it is. and you can buy it, I suppose, at all the Amazon and everywhere else.
Yep.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Look forward to reading myself. All right. Well,
thanks, Jeff.
And best of luck.
All great right, to see you. Give my best to Julie.
All right, I will. I will.
Take care.
All right, everybody. That was Roy Johnson, just a great author. I've read a couple of his prior books and can't wait to read this one. But now we have an incredibly exciting announcement, and we've got lawyer extraordinaire Randy Corcoran. Could we bring Randy up to the down screen. This is the most exciting news I've heard in a long time, for me personally anyway. But I think for the Republican Party, an incredible ruling out of federal district court that really came from nowhere. Quite frankly, wasn't expected. It had been briefed a long time ago. And an incredible victory for the Republican Party and Randy Corcoran and all the other lawyers. So, Randy, tell us what happened.
Well, you know, it's been in the background for so long, people may have forgotten that we are still forced by the laws of the state of Colorado to participate in a semi-open primary, which allows Democrats, unaffiliateds, anybody to right up to, you know, 6:59 on election day, announce that they want to vote in a Republican primary. So we have people who may or may not be Republicans, may or may not be trying to help us, could actually be trying to hurt us, able to step in to influence who our candidates are coming out of our primary elections. So John Eastman and me and others have been fighting this battle for some time. We've had preliminary injunction hearings in court.
It really goes back to 22 when you're in front of Judge Kane.
The first time, and we refiled it in 2023. That's the case now. We just got the summary judgment order on. I think we closed briefing and summary judgment in June or July, maybe of last year, or maybe even before that. So we just went quiet because you never know when the court is going to rule. But this ruling is pretty exciting. It's not a home run. We still got a lot of work to do. But the judge last night
is. It's a partial home run. I don't know.
It's a base hit, baby.
Yeah, it's a strong single or double.
Because now this court has declared that the opt-out provision, the requirement that 75% of the entire Republican Central Committee vote in order for our party to opt out of the state-sponsored open, semi-open primary, is unconstitutional.
75%, but the one they were tricky with, they made it 75% of the membership. Therefore, if you didn't vote, if you weren't there or couldn't make it, you're considered to vote against it. So making it, you know, literally you did 80 or 90% of the people there. I mean, it was a great move because most people don't kind of, membership, sure. No, it means that every non-participant is a no vote if you're trying to get a yes to opt out. But luckily, Bremer seemed to see through that.
Yeah. And for people who don't quite understand what it meant is that every member of the Central Committee was counted as a voter and you had to get 75% of the entire membership to opt out. Most meetings, we don't have 75% participation.
Yeah, don't even go there. Right.
So it was virtually impossible. And so at least that constitutional impediment is gone. And or that physical impediment is now declared unconstitutional and it's gone. That does not mean that semi-open primary is gone. That's why I'm saying it's not a home run, but it is
we'll
a big
back to the second. But going back to this, I mean, and you've been doing the constitutional law. I mean, if the provision is unconstitutional, it's been unconstitutional since adopted. And we've had various elections. I think the last one, 64% of the people who were at the meeting anyway, voted to opt out. And it seems the court is saying, you know, the state cannot impose a bigger requirement than 50%. It doesn't say the party couldn't, but it says the state can't. As far as my reading of Robert's Rules of Order, which often apply, that if something says, okay, this needs to be approved by the state central committee or something, but doesn't say what it's to be, the automatic default is the majority. If a provision doesn't specifically say a majority, it becomes a majority. It doesn't become some other number. And therefore, when we did 64%, that was constituted or not that. And we reconfirmed that in our last meeting. So it seems to me that we've opted out. We don't need to have any more votes. We don't need to do anything else. We've officially opted out of the open primary system. Now, regarding the present primary, that's difficult because the practical matter, we're halfway through or whatever percentage through the system for getting primary ones. So it probably can't be done for this time. But it seems to me, and tell me what you think, that in fact, the opt-out is gone. Or the or the state mandated open system is gone. The requirement that a party has to do it one way seems to have vanished. Now, I'm sure you can interpret other ways, say, no, you need a super vote, but I'm not sure you do.
Well, I think your argument is correct. It's too late to make a difference now. Everyone has relied on the old system. This current upcoming primary is going to go the way that it goes. But the next opt-out vote is next year. They're every 2 years. And so I would stand on your argument that without a requirement, Republican Party operates under Robert's Rules of Orders, 50% plus one. Does the trick, and every vote we've ever had would have exceeded that threshold substantially.
Which is just, I mean, I can't tell you how many years you've been laboring at it, I've been laboring at it. Some people say, well, we shouldn't celebrate too much, and I go, oh, bullshit.
No, listen, you take the wins that you can get. This is
there's so few from federal courts or state courts and everything else. But now, as you've indicated, I mean, basically they said that the statute, allowing the state to have these semi-open primaries is constitutional as long as you don't have this provision in it. Without this provision, it's constitutional, which is a strange constitutional argument. You usually don't go in and kind of go, okay, we'll take this out, take that out. And then now it's constitutional. It's kind of like the whole law is not, and it wouldn't seem you'd have a severability where you go in and pick and choose, but I guess that's what the judge said. But as I understand it, please correct me if I'm wrong, we had a summary judgment motion by the Attorney General.
On behalf of Jenna Griswold, the Secretary of State.
On behalf of Jenna Griswold, the Secretary of State. And that was denied in full. And then we had partial summary judgment motion in which we had two claims, one that 108 in its totality was unconstitutional, and in particularly the obscene excessive majorities or super majorities to get rid of it. So it seems to me that you still have a trial coming up on the question of is 108 even as taken out of the opt-out percentage, is still a litigious and one you have to try the case with.
Absolutely. Our next step in this case will be to put the case basically back on the docket.
Yeah.
And that means a trial, not likely to happen before the end of this year, but certainly should happen early next year at the very latest. And the judge, he really relied a lot on Democrats versus Jones, which was the California case that we think wins the day ultimately in the Supreme Court over Prop 108 entirely, that says private, the government can't impose these requirements on private organizations. Republican Party is such a private organization. But then he also factored it in with another case that says, you have to carefully consider the state's interest in this case.
Well, it's a subsequent case that I thought, after it ruled in Jones, it would absolutely be, Freedom of Association would have won. And I think even Justice Thomas wrote it. It was a bizarre sort of limitation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the name of that case? I forget. But
I'm looking for it right now. Klingman. Klingman and Tashajan is the name I think that's usually used, that says the states still have flexibility in how they manage elections. So there's two seriously conflicting opinions that the Supreme Court is ultimately going to have to resolve. And way back at the beginning of this,
they have to resolve, two different courts have different decisions, the Fifth Circuit. It seldom you kind of win it. You guys have to resolve the fact that you made these two contrary rulings.
Yeah, I get it. Way back at the beginning, our ultimate goal obviously is to win, overturn Prop 108, let the party decide how they select their own candidates.
Right.
But the real goal was to present these very powerful and strong legal positions positions, if properly applied, that we believe we ultimately win on, and get this case through the federal district court, then into the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. And then whoever loses at every stage is very likely to be filing subsequent appeals, eventually get this back in front of the Supreme Court, where I think Jones wins the day. It's a years-long endeavor, and we knew that going in. But man, this is a great, you know, it's like we get to step off the escalator for a while and walk flat, you know, and gear up for the next phase with a victory in hand.
Yeah. And I guess you can sort of, the court has indicated it doesn't believe that it believes it can take out 108, take out the supermajority provision to make it pass constitutional muster. But you get a chance to go back in and say, no, that's not right. I mean, even without it, there are a lot of assumptions. The 22-page opinion, and I must admit, I loved reading it because the last one I read was Keynes. Not the last one, but the last one. The
Crushed us temporarily.
Oh, geez. No, you guys are not right about the time of day. You're not right about anything. Just any, whatever your argument, no. And so it's fun to see where, and really, I guess it overturns what Kane ruled in some.
And, you know, just I hadn't thought about Judge Kane and his ruling, but I just remember we had a 2-day trial in front of him on a preliminary.
I was there. I watched you. I think you gave me a great presentation.
He was so inquisitive and patient. Yeah. And I just thought we're going to get
the perfect judge. And then it's kind of like the, you know, he turned his head over and it was, you know, the whole opposite. And he wrote an opinion that was obscene. It was just obscene. It's an obscene opinion from, you know, it wasn't this even balanced, or at least to say, it was clear that whoever argued, he didn't want to be losing on appeal. So he's going to, you know, all he's going to do is whatever we did, he's going to make sure that he tried to squash it. And so, I mean, he had to have that opinion throughout the case, so give him credit for poker face, because I did not expect that kind of opinion, and I thought it was disgraceful. Really,
it was a shocker when we got it, for sure. I think it's important for your viewers to understand what it means to win on summary judgment,
right?
And why we still have a trial is in that at summary judgment, based on discovery, based on depositions, based on affidavits, and actual evidence that is before the court. Summary judgment gives a judge the chance to determine, based on the evidence that now exists, there's really no more question for me to decide. It is a clear-cut decision. Right. So the fact that he didn't overturn Prop 108 just means we have to have a trial and sort that out.
You can give totally new evidence to help.
Absolutely. People. Yeah, we'll have a whole other primary that we can build evidence from and submit for this trial when it occurs. But the judge was saying that our evidence on the 75% requirement to opt out was so clear, doesn't need a trial, doesn't need to hear from anybody. It's unconstitutional. That's a big deal.
Oh, that is absolutely huge. And so, I mean, it changes so much. And after, I mean, quite frankly, I think everybody after, I don't know how many months it's been of Britta Horn as party chair, is sort of, you know, desultory and feeling kind of, you know, non-energized about the party and everything else. And I think this changes everything. I think the grassroots should be really energized by this.
Yeah, I wasn't necessarily planning to speak at this next state assembly because there's not much to do with the chair standing down and people will decide about their candidates. I have to stay neutral on candidates as the Republican National Committee man for Colorado. And I will likely do that here unless it turns out, you know, we're down to where a vote might make a difference. I did speak up for Dave Williams when it looked like it could be a close call. And I just knew it was so important to have an opportunity for a different kind of leadership. And God bless him, the establishment wrenched it back and got Britta plugged in there after all the illegal shenanigans that they pulled trying to unseat Dave and everything else. And the party itself did not appreciate it, clearly.
No, that's for sure. And, we've got an election tomorrow if you're on the State Central Committee, and that's composed of about 500 people. for the vice chair. You
Yeah.
got Sandra Black, who's just this total establishment, really unpleasant human being. I don't know how else to describe her. She comes from Colorado Springs, I think, but I mean, just awful. And then we have Vic, who's our guy, not Garcia.
Eric.
Eric Coomer.
Okay.
Eric. Oh, geez, I got it. Eric.
I'm so bad with names. I rely on the host in this area.
Yeah. So I rely on the expertise of the guest. But vote for Eric. Whatever it is, vote for Eric. He's the one. It'll make a lot of difference. And it's going to tell us a lot how things change. By and large, Republicans grassroots have been about 55%, and the establishment 45%. Although it kind of depends a lot on the candidates themselves, and obviously, I don't think anybody disputed that Britta Horn won the last election. It was close. It was 53-47, and so you know, but I really wonder, you know, when we had the last vote of the state central committee, whether to vote on whether we had confidence in Ms. Horn. It was 80% said no. And that was a shocking percentage. So I'm hoping Rick, whoever you are, wins it clearly so that we show that the grassroots are back. And, you know, the establishment had their chance to take the party back, and what they drove it massively into debt. I mean, just massively into debt. We now owe a quarter million to the lawyer Klendike.
Steve Klenda.
And then we got like 60 or 50,000 cash, and so she has just run it into the ground. So I think hopefully people will kind of go, well, no, we don't want to do that again. And Black represents just doing it again. Just, why don't we destroy the party some more? But it's going to be an incredible. I'm looking forward to that vote, and I hope it shows that people have kind of we're paying attention. That the establishment, as far as it goes now, can't raise money, can't hold meetings, can't do about anything. And one thing about Dave Williams' time, he really ran a great meeting, and he really knew how to get the party funded. And he robbed Peter to pay Paul and raised $2 million during his term. Well, Britta, with supposedly all the establishment money behind her, of which there was none, can raise almost nothing. So it's amazing. So
I think people forget how important it is when they're analyzing the chair candidate, and we have to see who's all in there, that fundraising is the biggest goal. Running a meeting is right up there.
Right.
But if you don't have money, you can't do a thing. And
so
that was
ways
a promise that did not deliver.
Yeah, there's lots of ways to raise money. And if you have to be really smart, and I mean, like Dave Williams said, okay, look at all these other states charged as presidential candidates to have entry to our primary system. Let's do that. And he raised $250,000 doing it. And he did other things where it wasn't, you know, he did some tax ones and some other ones. It wasn't just going to Phil Anschutz and say, you know, please give us some money into the big donors. So we'll have to try to get somebody who's as imaginative and inventive as Dave Williams are to raising money. Because the big boys are not going to contribute. They're just not. We got to learn to live without it.
But, I have repeated a very famous Chuck Bonniewell aphorism many, many times when I was doing radio or when I was on other people's shows. And that is, the Republican Party in Colorado needs better billionaires.
Yes, yes. It's one of my earliest claims to fame.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen any come in, and they tend to be leaving these days. Palantir left, the big corporations are leaving, but maybe just one good. Oh, we need one decent billionaire.
We need somebody who knows how to run a business, organize, has made money, has spent money, and knows people with money, and can sell the message.
Yeah. And so, you know, there are lots of candidates. I'm not sure it's clear that any one of them has an absolute lock on those requirements, but I guess we'll see afterwards. So,
Well, I focus more on my role as national committee man, especially right now. I had very little influence on the current other leadership of the state party.
right.
The national committee woman and the chair were, part of the people who tried to perform the coup on Dave Williams. So we didn't have a lot. We were civil with each other. I don't hate anybody, anything like that. But we didn't have a lot to talk about as far as advancing the party. But boy, bringing somebody back in who cares about the grassroots, cares about conservative values, isn't just trying to cater to the Anschutzes of the world who've sort of run the party from the back checkbook for a long, long time. I just think it's really important. I don't know who all the candidates are. Do you have a, given your expertise on names that we established earlier?
Total photographic memory on names. We got Craig Stever.
Craig Shriver, is it Shriver? Stiver.
Diver. Okay, there we
Yeah,
go.
that's a good man right there.
What'd you say? A good man?
He's a good man, yeah. I
Yeah.
don't know enough about where he's at these days to know if
He's
he's a
not
good
really in favor
party,
of it, about being
but he's a
out.
good guy.
Well, KBB was a good person too at
Yeah,
one
no,
point.
I know. I'm not commenting on whether they should become chair at all, but for
And
sure.
Joe Oldham had resigned from being a governor candidate, and now he's running for chair. He'd be an interesting one, no question about it.
Joe could raise money.
Yes, Joe could raise money. And I'm not sure who the establishment hack is, unless Craig is a secret establishment hack. But he had some good endorsements from Patrick Neville, who I love, and from some others. But he also had Frank Minolti and a few others who, ooh, that's a bad endorsement. So I don't know. I guess hopefully that'll be fleshed out. But he seems a lot like Christy Burton Brown. On the surface, hey, maybe good. He's got great personal skills, professional, good business background, a lot of great things. But also in the Republican Party, if you don't believe in, he calls himself a common sense conservative. Well, if you got to put a qualifier before conservative, that generally speaking, conservative means not common sense, you're saying, I'm not a conservative. I'm a common sense one, which means I'm really a rhino. And he writes for Complete Colorado. So I don't know. Maybe he'll change all our minds.
Yeah, George, I wasn't actively involved in politics during the George W. Bush years, but I was paying attention. I was a, a business owner. Things mattered to me. And when he was talking about being common sense conservative and talking about violating the fundamental rules of free markets in order to save the free market, I was done. Done.
Well, we may have another George W. Bush on our hands. So maybe not. Maybe I'm being mean. I don't mean to be close my mind to it, because I think
No.
if his political belief, I think absent his political beliefs, which I'm not sure on, he'd be a perfect candidate. If it's just for business background presentation, he could run a meeting and he could do a lot of good things.
Sure.
All right, Randy. Well, it's great to see you. Great for
What do
tremendous.
you expect to happen after? What do you expect to happen after the meeting? Britta has announced her intention to resign. Then what? We'll have a call for a chair election, and
Well,
people
you'll
do
have
their thing.
whoever is chosen as vice chair will assume the duties anyway of the chair, and he'll have to call a meeting for the one within 30 days of April 17th.
April
And
11th.
April, I thought it was the 17th she said she was resigning.
Oh,
Well, I don't know.
I thought the Central Committee meeting was a week from Saturday, so I'm going to check because I'm not driving to Pueblo otherwise.
All right. Well, whatever date it is, she's resigning after that meeting, so hopefully we'll never see her again. I think everybody universally would say the worst party chairman in the history of the Republican Party, going back to 1876. So that's a long haul. That's a long haul.
Well, I don't know. I just know from executive committee meetings and budget meetings and the meetings where we tried to, just get things to happen that the party is in the worst shape that I've ever seen it in. I've only been committee man for 6 years, but right. I've never, and it changed so quickly from the way it was left. Dave left money in the bank account, and paid bills, handled everything like a pro. And I really can't wait to get to the bottom of the Colorado GOP attorney bills and debt.
Seems
extra. I don't have a position on it yet because I haven't read enough or heard enough, but man, it sounds fishy and ugly to me.
Well, I saw the legal bills, if you want to call them those, for the people who were arguing on the other side, and they were, you know, 5,000, 10,000.
Yeah.
And I have one that was 30,000, 40,000, 50,000, which tells you, whoa, and he'd lose them all. So, you know, but we'll have time to do it because he's refused to turn over those bills, except under, you know, incredibly unreasonable non-disclosure agreements and everything else to members of the executive committee. He said, no, I'm not going to turn them over to you. Well, that tells you something.
We'll force that issue after we change leadership. I guarantee it. And we just simply have brighter days ahead. The opportunity for a new leader who can bring everybody back together, raise money, and no 75% majority required to opt out of open primaries.
Well, it's great.
God bless America, brother.
Congratulations. And we'll talk to you later.
Take care, Chuck.
Bye-bye. Well, that's it, everybody. I've gone a little over our time period because I just love the exciting news. But we'll be back on Monday and we'll tell you all about the vice chair race and whether my favorite guy, Rick, has won and whether Miss Black has lost or vice versa. So take care.